For the week of September 18th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 119, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you doing this week, Michael?
I'm doing great. We got the start of the New York Film Festival, so I'm excited about that. We also have the start of the New York Musical Festival, in which new musicals are given showcases around the city. So, and the Yankees are in town for their last run before the end of the regular season on Sunday. So I'm a busy fellow in the next few weeks.
No, you're covering all of those events, I take it, except for the Yankees.
I'm going to the Yankees, but I'm not covering it for anyone.
Well, we will be talking about some stories that were covered this week. Maybe not by yourself or me, but on today's show, we'll be talking to Ann Thompson of Thompson on Hollywood, which can be found on IndieWire. Anne is just back from the Toronto International Film Festival, and she'll tell us all about it. The Emmy Awards were held last night, and we'll discuss all the surprise winners, the not-so-surprising winners, and, well, I guess all the highlights. We'll do that right after some movie news, in which we discuss the shock that films actually make more money internationally than they do in North America. In music news, apparently fans still want to own their music rather than rent it, we'll explain. During Inside Baseball, we'll talk about why Netflix is getting a divorce. That's right, Netflix is getting a divorce from itself. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the number one movie at the box office worldwide, in a bit of a shocker, is The Lion King, basically in 3D.
It's 2011. I'm sorry. You must have notes from 1994 in front of you. So maybe if you could shuffle your...
This is a 1994 film, but it's been re-released into theaters, and it grossed an astonishing $29.3 million in North America. It has been open overseas for a little while, and it hasn't done nearly as well there. So this turns everything on its head. We've been hearing for a while that 3D is still really big overseas, but people in America are starting to resist it. Obviously, the only draw for this movie was to see it in 3D because it's available on DVD and most families own it who want it. So people did turn out and go to the box office to see this movie in 3D. It's one of the highest grossing films of all time, obviously, including this weekend. It's grossed $813 million worldwide to date.
You mean the 3D version? Or
no,
the film in general.
Okay. I'm counting Lion King overall. The fact that they've refurbished it into 3D, I think it's essentially the same film. So I'm adding it to its total box office.
You know, I wouldn't say that it's just 3D. Certainly parents with children are looking for something to do with their children on the weekend. And this is a perfect excuse to spend 2 hours in a dark room with them.
And it's a safe bet. It's a movie that you like. This is, of course, what Disney did for many years. They had all their movies on a 7-year cycle, their classic animated films. Every 7 years, they release Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Every 7 years, they release 101 Dalmatians and so on. They would stagger them and keep re-releasing them. Then came VHS and DVD, and they very nervously started selling movies on VHS and were a big promoter of the trend of people buying movies and owning them in their home. And, you know, it worked great because kids love to watch movies over and over and over again. But that meant that Disney stopped usually re-releasing their movies in that same pattern that they'd always done. That was where they made their money in the 60s and 70s, just putting out their old movies again and again.
Yeah, but, you know, they did the same thing, that same pattern with VHS and then DVD sell-through, in that they would release a film like The Lion King. They'd release it for a limited time and then they'd put it on moratorium, usually for, guess what, 7 years.
That's right. That's when they figured a whole new batch of kids has shown up. So it's been a long time since they've been able to make money off their library in theaters. It's quite expensive to convert to 3D. How much did it cost? Do you know, Sperling?
It's usually about, well, years ago, and by years, I mean two years ago, it was $1,000 a minute to convert. I would say a film like this probably did cost about $1,000 a minute. It's not as expensive anymore to convert a film from 2D to 3D, but I wouldn't be surprised if they said it costs anywhere between $750 and $1,000 a minute.
So what does that mean as a film?
Or maybe it was second. No, it had to be minute. I don't know. I'll have to look that up. But it's very expensive.
Yes, I mean, it was over $10 million, I believe, to convert the movie.
Yes, that is true. I mean, at one point, Jeffrey Katzenberg says it added about $15 million to the budget of one of his animated films over at DreamWorks Animation. And that has come down over the years, so now it's probably around $8, $9, $10 million to convert a film such as The Lion King into 3D.
Especially when you're going to do it right and take your time, obviously.
That's right.
So that's a serious investment of money, to $10 million to put it out in theater for a film that's 17 years old.
That's right.
Especially when it's widely available on DVD. But then they get to sell it on 3D as well, you know, on Blu-ray and DVD. So, you know, this paid off big. And obviously we're going to be seeing, you know, we know we're seeing Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid, and all the others will be coming out in 3D down the road.
Well, you know, Beauty and the Beast was done first in 3D, and they didn't release it the way they had intended last fall because they couldn't get the number of screens and there was a glut of 3D. And, they, you know, there were many reasons they decided not to release it. And so they held the 3D version of Beauty and the Beast for, I guess it's going to be next year sometime.
Why did they put Lion King ahead of it?
Just because they had always planned on releasing Lion King in 2011. So they just kind of pulled Beauty and the Beast and they're going to reinsert it somewhere. But ultimately, this is good news for films such as Titanic, which will be released in, I think it's March or February of next year, 2012, mm-hmm. in That's 3D. Right. So what this shows is people are willing to go see a film, even if they own it on DVD or Blu-ray, they're willing to go see it in 3D in a movie theater again.
If you make it right, if you do it well, and it's a big event film, we've seen that people have a huge resistance to 3D regularly. Families are getting tired of taking their kids to every movie every week being in 3D. I'm sick of it. I don't want to pay an extra $4. I would have gone to see Lion King again in 2D. There were some screens where it was available on 2D. I'm sick of paying the 3D premium. But for a really, really big event film like Titanic or Lion King, two of the biggest films of all time, when you do it right, yes, there's a market for it.
Right.
You know, this really is an astonishing success story. That's why we're spending so much time talking about it before we get to the other movies. It's September. We haven't really gotten into the big fall releases yet. This blew everybody away, blew way past their expectations. But of course, there are other films that came out this week. At number two at the box office worldwide is The Smurfs, which I think has been number one for 6 weeks overseas. It grossed another $17.3 million. It's at just under $500 million worldwide. At number three worldwide is Contagion, which is only open in the U.S. basically. Its second week, it grossed $14.4 million. It's at $44 million total and waiting to open around the rest of the world. At number four worldwide is Johnny English Reborn, a movie franchise which most people in America probably aren't even aware of. It stars Rowan Atkinson, who was in the Mr. Bean films, as well as Four Weddings and a Funeral. And he's a big star around the world in Johnny English and Mr. Bean. Johnny English is a spoof of James Bond. This is a sequel. It grossed $11.7 million worldwide. It will make a ton of money all over the world, just really not that much money in America. It edged out Drive, which opened up basically only in North America. That's the Ryan Gosling thriller, which has been very critically acclaimed and had a decent opening.
And it was also in Cannes. We saw it in Cannes.
We did see it in Cannes, where everybody else liked it more than me. I love Ryan Gosling. I just was not thrilled with the movie, but everybody else thought it was great. And the critics all agreed. At number six worldwide is Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which grossed $10.4 million. It's at almost $400 million worldwide, and it still has three big markets to go: Italy, Japan, and China. And isn't it fun to say that China is now a big market? And it really is. And that really is a change over the last 10 years.
Well, yeah, especially since they sell all those DVDs on the street there. I mean, you know, never mind.
At number seven is Friends with Benefits, which grossed another $9.2 million worldwide. That's at just under $100 million. At number eight is Final Destination 5, which grossed $6.5 million worldwide. At number nine is The Help, which grossed another $6.4 million in the U.S. It did open in Australia, where it grossed $5 million so far in total, but we're not really getting a lot of figures. It seems to have fallen quickly in Australia, and it's got a lot of other countries to go. We'll see. I'll have to see how it does. But worldwide, it's grossed $153 million so far. At number 10 is Captain America, which grossed $5.6 million worldwide. We'll talk more about that in a minute. At number 11 is a movie that opened in the U.S. and did very poorly, Straw Dogs, the remake of the Dustin Hoffman film, that grossed $5 million, which puts it in a tie with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, a British thriller which opened in the U.K. only. It's the Cold War story by Jean Le Carré. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but it was a solid opener in the U.K. And you can see local fare doing well all over the world. This week, movies topped the box office that were locally produced in the UK, Mexico, France, Germany, and Japan. And it's always good to see, you know, local products succeeding and doing well in their home countries.
And yet this is the week that it was made public that Disney is actually getting out of making local fare. They are, they had, actually it was the biggest panel at CinemaCon this past March was the local productions that studios were getting into. There was a panel discussion on it, and Disney had a Jason Reed up there talking about how they were making all these films in local languages all over the world, and now they're getting out of it because what have they realized? That actually American films, their regular Disney films like Pirates of the Caribbean, were doing just fine overseas, and they didn't have to worry about these local productions and these local language productions eating into their profits on Hollywood films.
Well, I don't know if it's a question of worrying about them eating into it, but saying, hey, here's people making money with making movies. And if we can be involved on the local level, you know, if you do The Office in the U.S., why not do The Office in Germany and The Office in South Africa?
Well, they are doing that now.
Right, I know. But I'm saying, why not be involved in that business and make money? The important thing is to know, are you good at it? Do you have the people on the ground locally who know that culture, know that country, know that film industry, and where you can do a good job at it? Maybe Disney said, you know what? We don't really have the people on the ground to make this work, so we need to get out of it.
Well, what they decided was they do have people on the ground, but they work for other companies, and they'll just partner with those companies.
There you go. So they'll save on overhead, I guess.
Right, exactly.
And the final movie that we'll mention, it's at number 13 worldwide. It's at number 6 in the U.S., another very poor opening for Sarah Jessica Parker, her new romantic comedy, I Don't Know How She Does It, which opened to $4.5 million in the U.S., which I guess means we can look forward to Sex and the City 3.
Yeah, well, how about I Don't Care How She Does It? When are they going to make that movie?
I like Sarah Jessica Parker. She's married to Matthew Broderick. I like her. Can't help it. You know, she hasn't made a lot of good movies, but there you go. But I mentioned we were going to talk about Captain America. Can you tell people why?
Well, I was alluding to this a little bit when we were talking about international box office, because I got this email in my inbox, as opposed to where else would I get an email? Anyway, it was from The Hollywood Reporter, box office shocker, the subject line read. Captain America grosses more overseas than it does in North America. And I thought, where have these people been that they don't know that films make more money overseas than they do in the U.S.? So I opened up the intent of the headline, but I opened up the article, and sure enough, it's saying, well, because the word America was in the title, we didn't think it would do very well overseas. And it's made $178 million overseas versus $173 million domestically in North America.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, the shocker is that it hasn't made more overseas.
That's right.
Because, you know, that's where the money is made. Yeah, I had the same reaction. I thought the email was ridiculous. I thought, what world do you live in? I mean, there are always counterexamples, but I did not think the word America in the title was that much of a deficit. And in fact, they offered to countries, if you want to just rename the film The First Avenger, we'll let you. Only three countries took them up on it: Russia, Ukraine, and South Korea. So clearly, all the local markets around the world said, look, it's not a problem, buddy, relax. And if you think about it, Captain America has comic books published in 78 countries. It's set during World War II, which Europeans are pretty familiar with. And, World War II, it's set in World War II in Europe. So, that's where most of the action takes place, or a lot of it, I should say. It's only a shock when a tentpole movie like this doesn't gross more overseas than in North America. And they kept saying U.S., by the way. In the article by Hollywood Reporter, they kept saying U.S. box office, when in fact they mean North America, because it includes Canada. So that's a little insulting. But I went back and looked at this summer. Basically, every movie you can think of grossed more overseas than they did domestically. The only counterexamples are Green Lantern, which is still running slightly behind, but will probably pass it once it's open in every market, and Zookeeper, which is a comedy and not necessarily a tentpole movie. Kevin James is not a worldwide draw. But when you're talking about big movies that should appeal to people all over the world, like Thor, Harry Potter, Kung Fu Panda, X-Men, Cars 2, Transformers, Planet of the Apes, you name it, it all grosses more overseas. And if you look back, even comedies like Hangover 2, Bad Teacher, Bridesmaids, they all look like they're going to gross more overseas than they did in the U.S. And the big exception is Cowboys and Aliens. And that's because it opened in the U.S. first. And the bad buzz from the movie, which was so poisonously negative, I think kept it from earning as much money as it might have overseas. If they'd opened it worldwide at the same time, people wouldn't have known how bad it was, and it probably would have done better.
Yeah, they should have opened that movie either day and date, or they should have opened it internationally first.
But it was so hard to open at all. I can understand their problems. And if you look back last year, same thing. If you look in our show notes, you can see basically every film you can think of, every franchise tentpole movie, every animated film grossed more around the world than it did in the U.S. The exceptions are comedies, dramas, right, and indie films. But basically, any major studio movie grosses more overseas.
Well, it used to be a 60-40, split. It used to be 60% in the U.S., 40% overseas, then it was 50-50. Now I would say it's probably 30-70 or 40-60 the other way.
Absolutely. You know, especially with the big movies, you know, like Pirates of the Caribbean and Harry Potter, that cost $1 billion overseas.
Yeah. Well, globalization is working out for Hollywood then.
That's right. And that's they reach that worldwide audience at places like the Toronto Film Festival, where they can help launch their movies and get attention for them.
Well, Michael, you're absolutely right. For most studios these days, any studio that is looking to open an awards contender in the fall or holiday season, Toronto has become kind of a mandatory stop, along with maybe Telluride. After all, the last four Best Picture winners, Academy Award Best Picture winners, including No Country for Old Men, Slumdog Millionaire, The Hurt Locker, and The King's Speech, they all played at the Toronto International Film Festival. And Toronto, along with, of course, the smaller and cozier Telluride Film Festival, which takes place the weekend before, is where some of these films first start picking up their awards buzz. Ann Thompson, editor of Thompson on Hollywood, which can be found on IndieWire.com, was at this year's Toronto Film Festival and Telluride Film Festival, and she's here to give those of us who weren't lucky enough to go a few details. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And I'm jealous because I didn't get to go to Toronto this year. I just got too busy. Overall, how was the festival for you? Was it a banner year or a solid year or a weak year?
Solid. I mean, what was interesting to me was how Telluride, as ever, sort of cherry-picked the best titles, you know? So by the time I got to Toronto, I had really seen the best of what was there. I had seen David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method. I had seen Steve McQueen's Shame, both of them starring Michael Fassbender. I had seen the Werner Herzog Into the Abyss, it was a lot of good, you know. The Artist had already played and done really well there, even though it opened originally in Cannes. And The Descendants came out of Telluride and entered Toronto and did the same thing. Both of those films basically went straight to the front of the pack as far as the Oscar season is concerned. The Artist and The Descendants.
The Artist as a foreign language film or a...
No,
Best
it's
picture.
Not going to be the foreign submission. They picked another film, and it's really an English language film, even though it's made by French people and stars a few French people, including Jean Dujardin, who won Best Actor in Cannes. But actually, the rest of the cast is American, and it's shot in Los Angeles, and it basically has titles in English because... And they're speaking English. You can see them speaking English.
That's right. Right,
is
yeah.
In English. It's a silent movie.
That's right. Yeah.
A black and white silent movie.
It's a great film. And
it's one of my favorites of the year, certainly.
It's a real crowd pleaser. I mean, that's what I learned in Telluride. I mean, people just adore it.
Well, now, speaking of Telluride for a second, it's a wonderful festival in Colorado in a little ski town. Hard to get to, but if you can get to it, it's really worth attending. I kind of look at the Telluride Film Festival and the buzz that it's getting recently over the past couple of years kind of like maybe Sundance in 1983. You know, people were just beginning to discover it. There weren't 50,000 people attending it. And I get the feeling that in another 10 years, you're not going to be able to find a place to stay in Telluride during the film festival.
Well, the good news and the bad news, depending on how you look at it, is that it's contained in such a small space that there's no room for expansion. I mean, they have X number of passes. So it's really a question of getting that pass early enough so that you can go.
That's true. Yeah.
And that's why it's so lovely. I mean, it's just beautifully curated over the Labor Day weekend. You can count on seeing just... And they don't play the game world premiere, North America premiere, opening, closing. They don't do any of that. It's not a junket. It doesn't. There aren't a lot of interviews going on, although I did a couple. You know, it's really very civilized and summer campy.
Yeah, I mean, there are filmmakers.
It's like socially delightful.
Yeah, filmmakers just walking down the street. You know, I think I saw Mike Lee walking down the street, and then it ran into, I can't even remember, Slumdog Millionaire. His name is escaping me.
Danny Boyle.
Thank you. Yes. Wow.
I ended up, you know, you go into a little coffee shop to buy coffee and there's Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, buying coffee. That's what it's like.
Yeah.
And you go out to dinner. I had dinner with George Clooney with a group of people. I mean, what's not to like, right? You know, he's as charming as you think he is.
Well, I think what's not to like is maybe what Toronto having its thunder stolen. I mean, all credit to the people at Telluride for doing such a great job of picking their movies. Does Toronto need to push back a little bit so that they don't seem to be, you know, an also-ran? and say, well, hey, we need to have a few more exclusives there.
March, which, you know, they put their foot down, and for whatever reason, Sony has said, okay, we won't show Ides of March to Telluride. But it started out in Venice, and some people felt that perhaps that opening in Venice, that was the wrong place for it. I mean, George Clooney's very loyal. That's the one he directed, the political film, and he gives his films to Venice. He lives in Italy and so on. But honestly, the thing about Toronto is that it has a certain scale, and that is what makes the echo chamber, the media viral power, of just the sheer numbers of people covering that festival have that much impact. So it's an opportunity for a lot of people to see a lot of films in a short amount of time and come to a sort of consensus about which movies have the right stuff.
Well, I mean, Toronto now is being kind of dubbed by some critics and journalists and industry types, I suppose, as one of the most important festivals after Cannes, if not the most important festival after Cannes. Is that something you would agree with? I mean, you attend all these festivals, so you would
Well, I think it's a question of what each festival, it's a little too simplistic, I think. I mean, Cannes has an enormous impact, back where it is in May. Sundance has an enormous impact mostly on American movies and independent films. And I would argue that South by Southwest has a certain impact in a certain corridor as well in the spring. So, I mean, for the fall, for the awards season, no one comes close to Toronto. That's it right there.
But if you're going to name two festivals you could go to in a year, what would they be? If you could only go to two. Well, okay, we won't put you on the spot since you love all the festivals.
I wouldn't give up the Riviera for anything.
Yeah, I was going to say, how could you ever give up Cannes? I mean, Cannes is like Christmas for moviegoers.
But tell us about this is a big year for the Toronto because they moved into a new space, the Lightbox Theater. It was fully operational this year, though,
right? This is the first year that they really moved downtown. So the vibe was completely different. And it was very pleasant. It was good because last year I ended up everybody was like shuttling back and forth between the old area up around, you know, Yorkville and where all the hotels and the publicists were sort of accustomed to doing things up there and downtown. Now it's all downtown. It's very rare that you have to go back up. And it's very centralized and easy to sort of run around and get everything done. And it's, you know, the theaters are fun. It was great. I mean, I ended up seeing a lot of things, but it's also like I saw Moneyball. That was sort of the big Hollywood movie that played in Toronto, and I really liked that. I mean, I'm still up in the air about how much of an Oscar contender it is, and that's because much as I like it, I still have to see how the critics respond, see how well it does, see how it holds up over the long haul.
And up in the air, of course, was a film that actually showed at Toronto. Of course, the George Clooney film from, was it last year or am I getting old and senile and it was 2 years ago? I think it was 2 years ago.
You mean the Jason Reitman film?
Yeah.
Yeah. That came out of Toronto with bells on. That's a classic case.
Yeah. And Moneyball, it stars Brad Pitt and is based on a book about Billy Beane and how he took the Oakland A's from worst to first and winning the World Series.
It's an amazing story, and Bennett Miller deserves a lot of credit for keeping it real, if you like. It was a difficult project to translate, as good as the book was. You know, a lot of statistics and a lot of, you know, businessy kind of how you change the way the game is played. And it's not – what he did was he managed to make it not so much about baseball as about Billy Beane, who's a great character who goes up against the establishment and sort of, you know, changes the way an entire sport is handled, which is kind of amazing. And Brad Pitt does a great job with it. But you know, there were a lot of sort of wannabes up there, movies that needed to get picked up, that needed to get some momentum going. You know, whether it was The Lady, you know, this Luc Besson movie starring Michelle Yeoh, based on the real character from Burma. You know, this extraordinary woman, Suu Kyi, and there's also something like the Rachel Weisz, The Deep Blue Sea, which just got picked up by Music Box, you know, an amazing performance that would have a shot if the right people can get behind it and give it, you know, an Oscar shot and a box office shot if it can be handled in just the right way. And Searchlight picked up Shame out of Telluride, and it did very well in Toronto as well. And that's an interesting case of a movie that could be very small audience, but has such controversy around it because of its subject matter about a sex addict, and you know, see how that goes.
Now, this is the film directed by Steve McQueen, not the actor, of course, but the filmmaker.
He directed from Britain.
He directed Hunger a couple of years ago,
broke out Michael Fassbender in the first place.
That's right, and now Michael Fassbender, everybody is saying, is kind of a shoo-in for an Oscar nomination.
I don't know about that. I have a weird theory. You guys tell me how crazy I am. There's a movie that came out earlier this year starring Michael Fassbender called Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. And if you were to pick a movie that would be more likely to be an Oscar contender, it would be this sort of lovely period literary adaptation romance, you know. But a lot of people just say, oh, that's just for girls, you know. But
Jane Eyre was a very good adaptation, a very solid movie. I thought it was a nice, reserved, intelligent version of it. Both he and Mia, I don't know how to say
Wasikowski.
Her name.
Wasikowska.
Yeah, I thought they were both very strong. I don't know if it'll be remembered come Oscar time, but it can only
that's
help his profile.
That's going to be Focus's job, you know, to see if they can bring it back, and either, you know, maybe the critics can bring it back. But, you know, honestly, that's a more likely scenario to me than Dangerous Method or
playing Carl Jung in the David Cronenberg film A Dangerous Method.
Well, he's good in all three. You know, the question is, you know, can two of them help the third, you know? Because Shame is just such a maybe I'm guilty of underestimating the ability of the Academy to rise to difficult and transgressive subject matter. You know, they came through with Black Swan. You know, that didn't throw them at all. So this is difficult and transgressive subject matter.
Well, and there were, you know, it's also A Dangerous Method was directed by David Cronenberg, who is Canadian, as is actor turned director Sarah Polley, who's Take This Waltz, starring Sarah Silverman, was screened at Toronto. And I guess it made Miss Silverman a little nervous, since she kind of has a full frontal nudity piece in it.
No, that's the theme, full frontal.
Yeah.
Shame is you know, the Michael Fassbender's package is being hailed far and wide, not just by me.
But well, by I know Manola one of the movies
Dargis
you
and others.
But what you're saying is that it's not the package that UPS could come and pick up. Okay.
Well, yeah, and I know one film that you were touting as well was Rampart, starring Woody Harrelson.
Yes, that still hasn't been picked up. I mean, part of the question is with these films, you know, is can you take them? I mean, in the past, Fox Searchlight picked up The Wrestler and ran with it and did very well with it, got Mickey Rourke nominated and everything. But this time, you know, can somebody, you know, jump in and do something, you know, on a moment's notice? And some of these movies are ready to go, and some of them need more work and may not make it. Rampart, I think, needs as much extraordinarily careful handling as it can get, you know, and it almost, it, I think Chris Tapley actually made the point that it might have been even better served in January at Sundance, but, you know.
That's true, actually. I would tend to agree with that. Without having seen the film, just reading about it, I would say that does seem more of a Sundance film. Now, Chris Tapley is the editor of In Contention, which is now over at IndieWire. You host a show.
No, it's at HitFix.
Oh, HitFix. Oh, why did I get?
Yeah, no, I'm for better or for worse, I'm the Oscar blogger at IndieWire, and he's my colleague who I enjoy doing the podcast with every week, Oscar Talk. But he's moved over to HitFix.
Yes, this was all a way of me talking about Oscar Talk, or trying to get into Oscar Talk, because my question for you is, who comes out the real winner from this year's Toronto Film Festival, or is it nobody?
I'm saying The Descendants.
Okay.
No question. I mean, part of it is that it just like, you know, Kirsten Dunst got a little bit more steam behind her for Melancholia, but we still have to see how well does Melancholia do. You know, it's a strange, beautiful, bizarre movie that I adore, but you know, it's got to go a lot farther than me. You know, something like Barrymore with Christopher Plummer, I think that's kind of dead in the water. I don't think that's going to happen. W.E., Madonna's film, not going to happen. If the people behind Flowers of War, the Zhang Yimou, thought that it was going to get picked up in time for the end of the year, doesn't look likely. You see, Ides of March kind of lost a little steam in Toronto. It didn't arrive the way that they might have wanted it to, you know. And then there are little movies that did really well, like In Darkness, the Agnieszka Holland, or Separation from Iran. You know, we just have to see over the long, long haul. You know, Albert Nobbs, you know, you know, it needed a real big, yes, this is Glenn Close's to Lose kind of reaction. And instead, it got a kind of, she's okay. Janet McTeer's okay. Maybe the movie's not so great kind of reaction.
Yeah, I mean, last week when we were talking about that film, it stars Glenn Close, who plays, Michael, you know this better than I.
A woman posing as a man in order to get work.
Right. And I thought, well, do we just hand her the Academy Award now, or do we have to wait until March? But it's what you're saying is, well, maybe not.
She's really good in it, you know, she's terrific. And so is Janet McTeer, who kind of steals it. But she's playing a very tamped down, very reserved, quiet character. It's not big. And McTeer's big, but the movie isn't big. The movie's kind of small and quiet. That's, you know, these are the issues.
I think the only given is that Meryl Streep will get another nomination for playing Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady.
You know, I would have said that all along, too. And a lot of people have been assuming that these two women would be duking it out. But I keep being reminded that the movie, A, hasn't gone to any festivals so far. Why is that? And B, it's got Phyllida Law directing it. Now, we can all applaud her for having taken Mamma Mia into a, you know, worldwide hit. But if the truth be told,
it
wasn't
movie.
Very well directed.
Yeah. As understatements go, that is certainly one. But now, you know, Toronto, we've been talking a lot about which films got picked up and which films didn't. Was it a good year overall for acquisitions, which is kind of what Toronto is known for?
A lot of movies got picked up in Toronto, but they weren't picked up for big, big prices. Salmon Fishing in the Yemen is like the biggest one that looked the most commercial to the folks that picked it up. So otherwise, you have the IFCs and you know, Magnolias of the world doing their usual sort of, you know, low level, small, you know, something like Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights or something like the one, I'd say the popular hit title there, really popular title, was Lynn Shelton's Your Sister's Sister.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, so these are the films that got picked up, but nothing for, you know, nothing for big, big stakes, except for Salmon Fishing. But I mean, the thing to recognize in a way, which is sort of interesting, is that you can have a bunch of movies that play at Cannes and get, you know, the early reviews and the early buzz and the early attention. And then by the time they get to Toronto, they're kind of old news and everybody's focused on the new titles. And you want, you know, so The Artist really did do well in Toronto in terms of continuing the good buzz and the good feeling. But other movies like We Need to Talk About Kevin with Tilda Swinton or, you know, you just didn't feel a lot of conversation around that or around Melancholia.
Which was Lars von Trier's film.
Yeah. Well, whereas a new movie like Damsels in Distress, the Whit Stillman movie, that played really well. And it was a sweet, cute little movie that I could see doing a little bit of business for Sony Pictures Classics, which picked it up ahead of the festival.
Well, we look forward to not only continuing to read your blog, Thompson on Hollywood, which can be found at IndieWire.com. But of course, we can follow you on Twitter. AK Stanwyck is your username on Twitter. And we can hear you every week in Oscar Talk, which is not on IndieWire. I guess it's on HitFix now.
Oscar Talk is a weekly podcast that In Contention and Thompson on Hollywood do. It's just me and Chris Tapley. I put it up on Thompson on Hollywood. He puts it up on In Contention. We each have a blog that's on it. And he's just moving his independent blog over to HitFix. So You can find it on In Contention or you can find it on Thompson on Hollywood. We put it up at exactly the same time every Friday morning at 9 a.m.
Do you like Pacific. Call each other and synchronize your buttons when you press them so that they're
we
up at
do.
The same time?
That is the concept.
Wow. Well, apparently I'm all very confused about it because you are doing so much for so many, I don't want to say different outlets, but there, if you want to read Ann Thompson or hear
it's
Ann
okay.
Thompson.
It's all right. Thank you, Sperling. All right, I'm off. I'll say bye. Thank you.
Thanks
for your time.
Bye.
Well, I'm sorry that I missed Toronto. It sounds like it was another, festival where we get to catch up on a lot of movies, but I didn't miss the Emmy Awards. I watched them last night. What about you, Sperling?
I watched them. They, on the West Coast, they're on twice. Once at 5 o'clock when they actually happen, and then the tape delayed version at 8 o'clock. So if you really wanted to see it again, you didn't even need a DVR. You could just watch it again.
I honestly didn't know they did that.
Yes.
Why would they do that?
Because they have nothing to show at 8 o'clock because on the East Coast, they don't program anything.
But I mean, they don't do that because it's a live. Do they do that with the Oscars as well?
No, they don't.
All right. Well, there you go. Makes no sense to me. But there's two things to talk about. One is the show itself as a show, and the other one are the awards. Let's start with the show. I thought the show was a train wreck. I thought it was terrible.
Is it getting good reviews? Because I saw one good review of it, and I thought Jane Lynch was okay.
She wasn't the problem. She was fine. But, again, they think it's a variety show, and it's not a variety show. It's an award show. There was so much filler, and it was such bad filler that it was just frustrating. It was 14 minutes before they handed out the first award. They had nothing but the briefest clip of any single show. I defy anybody who doesn't watch those television shows to know what they were about after watching the Emmys. You didn't learn what Downton Abbey was about or Boardwalk Empire or even Mad Men. And, it was impossible. You couldn't get a sense of any single show or performance from the year. They had, 10-second clips from a million shows. What's the point of an award show where you're supposed to celebrate television where people who watch it don't know anything about the shows that you're celebrating?
And I think it's Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey, yeah. Downtown Abbey. It's not the urban version.
Yeah, I still don't know what that show is about. I have no clue.
Well, I love it. I saw it. It was very fun, entertaining. It's basically an upstairs, downstairs type melodrama soap opera set, around the wars. It's, the upper class and the lower class in England. And it's a well-made, well-done show.
Well, and it broke the world record this week for, I guess, most accolades, highest critical review ratings for a TV show. So all of the critics love it. And it beat out.
I don't know how Guinness Book of World Records figured that out. I don't know how they have determined this record that they're claiming for it.
I don't know, but previously it was Mad Men, Sons of Anarchy, and Modern Family which held that record.
Yeah, I mean it's the current record holder for the most positive critical reviews or something. It seems like a very nebulous, strange idea, but that's true. They did. Guinness did say we've determined this is the most acclaimed show right now in the world, Downton Abbey, and it was certainly the surprise winner for best miniseries. If only because it's not a best miniseries, it's a series. It was already renewed for a second season before it got nominated for an Emmy, but that's a different issue. About the show, there was just the horrible filler. The musical medley was terrible.
Yeah, what are those like little musical side notes that they were doing? That was awful.
Oh, well, they had TV stars like Wilmer Valderrama and others performing, and Joel McHale singing little descriptive vocalese type stuff like a drama is a show, whatever. It's like, we don't need filler. It's a 3-hour show, for God's sakes. Just, keep going. I found the announcer incredibly obnoxious. Years ago, somebody came up with an innovation. They said, hey, we got all that dead air when somebody wins an award and they walk up to the stage. Let's fill that dead air time with a little pertinent information about the star. It was sort of interesting the first time they did it. Then it became stupid. Now they make snarky comments.
I know. They were so rude. And I just did not like that particular. And Judd Apatow on Twitter said that he was hiding under the sheets every time that announcer voice came on.
Yeah, I mean, it was just awful. All the jokes that the presenters were forced to make, when they're forced to make stupid banter as if it's supposed to be casual and off the cuff, horrible. There was barely a single good joke. The skits were terrible. I mean, it just was terrible. Here's a clue, Emmy people. If you're going to have a taped announcement thing, announce the nominees, and it's going to say, best supporting actor in a drama, don't make the celebrity person say, here are the nominees for best supporting actor in a drama, followed by the best supporting actors in a drama. I mean, we kept hearing that phrase repeated over and over again after, every 5 minutes.
Yeah,
it's just a technical thing. It's like, have them say the nominees are, and then the voice says, best supporting, for God's sakes, then can't they see what's going on? It was just a train wreck, I thought. It was absolutely horrible. It was a unendurable show.
Well, I think one of the highlights, if not a highlight, then certainly one of the more interesting moments was when Charlie Sheen showed up.
That's right. You saw John Cryer sort of notably trying to be polite and clap, and he made a joke about being referred to as a dwarf later. Jimmy Fallon gave him a standing ovation, and he came out and said, "I wish you all the best."
You're right.
It was a very strange moment.
It was supposed to be like somewhat contrite and apologetic, and you know, I don't know if it came off that way. It came off as forced and uncomfortable. And he had been, Charlie Sheen, that is, he had been on the Jay Leno show promoting his comedy roast on Comedy Central. And he was kind of sorry. He said, "Look, you know, I would have fired me too." But I don't
know. Did he say that?
Yeah. He
That doesn't help your lawsuit.
Well, I think, you know, as manic people are, they go from one extreme to the other. I think he's at the other extreme now, and he realizes, wow, what a jerk I was back then. And he will probably do it again, given that it is an illness.
Well, so the show was, I thought, very bad. But now we have the awards to talk about. There was a fair amount of fresh voting, of fresh winners in a lot of categories, which was fun. But when you look at the overall top winners, it was a depressingly familiar sight. Mad Men was best drama for the fourth year in a row. Modern Family won best sitcom for the second year in a row. And Amazing Race and The Daily Show won best reality and, you know, talk show for the 100th year in a row. I mean, it was just, that's the Emmy's worst trait.
Well, actually, The Amazing Race did not win last year.
No, they didn't win in a row. They've won it for the 9th out of the 100th time. Yes.
Yes.
That last year was Project Runway. No, it was Top Chef.
I guess. Yeah, I can't remember.
I believe it was Top Chef that won.
I can't even remember what blog In Contention went to. So, yeah, I'm not going to remember who won the best reality series from last year.
Year after year after year, the Emmys like to reward the same shows over and over again. They end up missing other shows when they should, and they reward them too late, like Friday Night Lights, which finally won, which I was thrilled to see, a writing award and best actor for Kyle Chandler, which was a terrific acknowledgement for a show, which briefly was the best show on television.
It was canceled, so it was kind of like a...
Well, it was its fifth and final season, so canceled isn't quite the right word. You know, it had a good 5-year run. So, I mean, that was a terrific accomplishment for a show.
Well, and then Melissa McCarthy won for Mike and Molly, which seemed to be a surprise for everybody. Now, there was this whole thing where, I guess, all the supporting actresses, or was it lead actress?
Lead actress.
Lead actress ran up on stage. Lead actress in a comedy series ran up on stage when they were announced. And I thought, wait, is that supposed to... Amy Poehler did it first. I thought, is that... Did she do that on her own, or was that pre-planned? Because it looked initially like she just did it to be funny, and then everybody else followed suit. But then
that was the joke. They you know, she pretended to be going up there on her own as if she'd already won or was going to win. And then they all did it, and then you realize it was all planned. They held their hands like beauty pageant contestants, and when they announced the winner, they gave her a tiara and roses, just like, you know, Miss America. So I thought it was actually the one funny shtick of the entire night. I mean, it wasn't hilarious, but it was okay.
Right. I thought the best speech was given by Ty Burrell?
Yes.
The Modern Family, the
He gave a tribute to his dad.
Yeah, but it was funny and witty, and it told a story, and it progressed. I thought that really worked.
Well, and the other thing that was nice about that was that his co-star won that award the previous year, so it was an example of them giving the award to the same person again and again. Even though it was the same show, at least they were spreading the glory around a little bit, so that was nice.
Yeah, and I think that I was a little shocked that Jim Parsons won for Best Supporting Actor.
Best lead actor in a sitcom.
I need some ginkgo biloba or whatever that drug is, or that.
It's not your day.
It's not my day. I can't remember anything. I can't even remember the supplement I'm supposed to take so that my memory improves.
Jim Parsons won for the second year in a row for The Big Bang Theory. I certainly thought Steve Carell should have finally won it. I mean, he should have won years ago, in which case you wouldn't need to give it to him now. But, you know, it was the goodbye for him from The Office. It's been like 6-7 years. He deserved to have won it before. He should have won it this year. I thought it was a shame, but that's what the Emmys do. It's very frustrating.
I wonder if there were splits, though, like vote splits that kind of caused someone like Jim Parsons to rise up.
Well, there were a lot of close categories this year. I think there were very few obvious wins in the acting areas. You know, there were obvious wins in the top races because they all won again after having won many, many years previously. But in the acting awards, I think it was fairly, you know, nebulous. You weren't sure that Juliana Margulies was going to win Best Actress. You weren't sure about almost anything, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think just last week, Mark Berman was saying that Mad Men would give it up, would not be the best drama series of the year. And indeed, shocker or no shocker, they won.
Yes, that's true. There were a lot of other shows that could have done it. But, you know, I mean, Michael C. Hall should have won for Dexter years ago. Kyle Chandler, thankfully, finally won for Friday Night Lights. He should have won 4 or 5 years ago. You know, there's just no, you know, it's a predictably tiresome show when it comes to the top awards. But at least this year, there was a lot of fresh faces in the acting areas. The biggest problem for the show for me in the awards is that they need to have a committee that makes sure shows are nominated in the categories to which they belong.
Well, they do. It's called the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. They just don't do a very good job of it.
No, but they need to have a panel that focuses on this because people can submit shows for their own categories. You know, they say, you know, like Modern Family tries to say everybody's going to be best supporting actor. You know, they need to step in and say, no, this does not belong in this category and make executive decisions. It's ridiculous. Downton Abbey is not a miniseries. It was already nominated for a second season, and yet it won Best Miniseries. It's kind of ironic because it beat out Upstairs, Downstairs, among other films and miniseries. And 40 years ago, I guess, in the 70s, it was very controversial when Upstairs, Downstairs won the Best Series Emmy. All the major networks said, that's ridiculous. It's only 12 episodes. It's not a real series. Why are you letting it compete with us? And it was very upsetting to them. And so they moved Upstairs, Downstairs to the miniseries category, even though it ran for 5 seasons. Nowadays, of course, a lot of shows have 6-episode runs or 12-episode runs. It's easier to maintain quality, as Mark Berman says, but tough. That's the world we live in now. You can tell a difference between a series and a miniseries. A miniseries is something like Mildred Pierce, which is never going to come back again or have a season 2.
Yeah,
that's
miniseries. For sure.
Even a miniseries can have a sequel like Roots or, you know, War and Remembrance or this year's Pillars of the Earth. There is a sequel to that book that was written. If they're happy enough with the success of it, they might make another miniseries based on that other book. But it's not a series that's going to be ongoing for year to year. Well, there were so many categories where shows were in their wrong section.
Yeah, and we've definitely talked about that before. And kind of like we've talked about Ricky Gervais as a award show host. He's hosted the Golden Globes for the past 2 years. This year, very controversially, he was on the show last night via satellite because he said that the U.S. won't let him in the country during an award show anymore. And that was very funny. His whole bit there, I thought, kind of worked.
It was okay. But it was certainly a highlight of the comedy. No question about that compared to other stuff. And now he has this gimmicky idea. Maybe he won't host the Golden Globes, but he'll just do it online with friends and riff and make fun of the show while they watch it. Sort of the things you might do with your friends if you get on a cell phone or get together to watch a show and make snarky comments.
Yeah, but I mean, if you've ever heard any of his podcasts, they really work. So it would be
He's a very funny man, yeah.
Yeah, it would be very funny to see. And then all of a sudden he's getting, you know, he posted that to his blog and then he's getting sponsorship offers to sponsor the him and his friends like Louis C.K., Chris Rock, or Carl Pilkington, or Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart would be at the Emmys, or not the Emmys, the Golden Globes probably. So I don't know. I mean, would you listen to that?
No.
You wouldn't. You would watch
I don't have enough time to, you know, listen to audio commentary of a secondary sniping of a show. You know, okay. It's tiresome enough to listen to the show.
Well, since we're talking about television, the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, did a survey which highlights the TV's continuing struggle with diversity. And they do this every year. And out of the 2,600 episodes of 100 scripted series on broadcast and cable during the 2010-2011 season, they found out that white males directed 77% of all episodes, white females directed 11% of all episodes, and minority males directed 11%, and minority females only 1%. And so they're saying, you know, this is a kind of a trend that needs to be reversed.
It's a trend. It's a longstanding truism, I guess. I wonder why they limited it to scripted series. I guess they don't care as much about reality shows. I wonder if the numbers were probably the same or even worse. I don't know. I don't know of any facts that women have made inroads in reality television, but I'd be interested to know about the facts on that as well. It's a sad truth. You know, there's a little bit better visibility in front of the camera, I think, clearly, especially with so many cable channels, but there's always a lot more work to be done. And this is, you know, if you don't get a chance to direct episodes, you're never going to get a chance to create a show. You're never going to get a chance to make a movie. You know, you can't work your way up the ladder if you can't get your foot in the door. And I should say that we talked last week or the week before about the Kennedy honors. And I said, oh, it's the same old stuff, you know, nothing surprising here. But one Latino group did point out it's been like decades since you've had more than one Latino person receive a Kennedy honor. And certainly that's another example of a lack of diversity in the arts.
Yeah, good point.
But there's always, you know, there may be a lack of diversity in the arts behind the camera. But as far as ways to get access to music, you've got more opportunities and more diverse ways to do it than ever before, from downloading music to buying CDs to streaming it to listening to subscription services or things like Pandora and Spotify. I mean, there really are just a ton of different ways to access music today.
Well, I guess we're talking about some music news then. And you're right, Michael. There was a study recently that it turns out that even though there are all those diverse ways, how many times can we say diverse in this episode? Let's see.
Let's set a record.
Yeah, it'll be a drinking game. So everybody get your shot glasses ready. In any case, music fans apparently prefer ownership over streaming their music.
Well, I'm not surprised. This is how I've always felt. I feel very, you know, I want to own the music and know I have access to it. And that if I suddenly stop paying my $10 a month, I don't lose access to every song I've ever owned, you know. You know, this is the problem with subscription services. You got to pay every month. If you decide you don't have the money, suddenly you have zero music.
That's right. Now, eMusic and Insight Research Group say that 92% of music fans are, they've concluded, they prefer they own their music rather than stream it. And they cited the unlimited playback and file security as key determining factors. So exactly what you're saying, Michael. And they did say that streaming music was kind of a gateway drug, if you will, that it would help people make a decision on what music to purchase. 71% of consumers these two groups polled, they use streaming to discover and listen to new music in order to gauge whether they should purchase it.
Just like you might listen to the radio, you can go to Pandora and Spotify and other stuff, check out new music, or maybe go to their site online, hear the songs, and then decide, okay, it's worth buying. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, 13% of that population of 1,000. So the survey had a sample of 1,000 male and female respondents between the ages of 18 and 64. So it was all ages. It wasn't just, you know, people in their 50s who were used to buying CDs. They said only 13% of them were actually willing to pay for music streaming services. And 20% were more dedicated consumers who actually paid. That makes no sense.
They're saying what this is you again, not your
I
best
need
day.
I need whether it's wheatgrass juice
of the people they surveyed, 13% who are of all the people they spoke to, 13% pay for music streaming services. But when they focus on the people who are really serious music listeners, not just anybody they happen to get on the phone, 20% of them are paid to stream music. So they're saying that one out of five people who are really, you know, into music do pay to stream music. I assume younger people are a lot more comfortable with doing that than older people like me. So I'm figuring people who are 18 to 25, they have no problem, I imagine, with streaming music. I imagine to them it's very natural. They don't, why do I need to buy a CD? I imagine it's a generational shift, and we'll see it becoming more and more true that people are a lot more comfortable with streaming services than they are right now.
Well, speaking of which, they can then turn to MOG. M-O-G is the name of this streaming service. It's been around in the U.S. for longer than, say, Spotify, which launched this past July, and I am now a paid subscriber of. Apparently, Spotify, which has a free version, so it's got free $5 and $10. Those are the subscription levels. MOG, which never had that, has said, well, we'll have a free version, a $5 version, and a $10 version per month. So they are kind of being pressured by Spotify to do that, but now I'm going to give them a try.
Well, I like this though. They have a thing where they give you, you know, free access. They give you sort of a gas tank to show you how much you've got in your tank as far as how much music you can listen to that month or whatever it may be. And the more that you're active on the site by like sending playlists to friends, bringing in new users, the more access they give you to the site. So you're encouraged to share the news, play with it, you know, use it to get the word out about music you like. And if you do, you'll get access to more free music, which is the way it should be.
So then you'd say that feature is kind of a big deal in regards to that particular service.
I most certainly would. What time is it?
Well, I think it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, but I can't remember, so
let's move on anyway and do it.
Yeah, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone can remember them. No, if anyone should care about them. Apparently, I could write for the Emmys.
I didn't even realize it was a joke. I thought it was a mistake.
No. Today, it very well could be. Well, anyway, our first story today, actress Emma Thompson has made two films based on the best-selling children's book about Nanny McPhee, and she won an Oscar for writing the screenplay to Sense and Sensibility. So who better than Emma Thompson to pen the first original Peter Rabbit story since Beatrix Potter back in 1930? Thompson will write The Further Adventures of Peter Rabbit, in which said bunny heads to Scotland, Potter's childhood home, and meets a friendly giant. When Mr. Rabbit invited me to write a further tale, I was more honored than I can say, said Thompson in a statement. I hope I don't let him or his extraordinary creator down. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. This is what happens with franchises like this when they're going to go into the public domain. You can see again and again, Peter Pan, they didn't never wanted to do a sequel, but they knew once it went to the public domain, everybody would do it, so they might as well be first. Same thing with Gone with the Wind. And as soon as I read that, I thought, somebody must have died about 70 years ago, because it tends to be an author's life plus 70 years when you're talking about books. And sure enough, when you look it up, Beatrix Potter died in 1943. And that's why this is happening right now, because by 2013, Peter Rabbit will be in the public domain and anyone can write a Peter Rabbit story.
Well, in wildly related news, Universal Music just announced a super deluxe edition of the classic Rolling Stones album, Some Girls. The elaborate box set comes in three flavors, although I wouldn't eat it, depending on how much money you want to shell out for what remains their best-selling studio album. Featuring their eighth number one hit, Miss You, Beast of Burden, and more. And why is it coming out on the 33rd anniversary of the album, as opposed to the 30th or the 35th? Because Some Girls came out in, you guessed it, 1978. This may be Universal's last chance to milk one of the jewels in their catalog, and by God, they're going to do it. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I think you're going to see tons of reissues coming out every year based around movies, these albums that are going to fall into the domain of control of the artists who made them originally. So all those albums from 78 and the next year 79, then 1980, and they're just going to say, hey, this is where we make our money right now. It's on catalog reissues, so we better do it while the going's good.
Mamma Mia became the 10th longest running show in Broadway history last week.
Mamma Mia!
That's right, passing Miss Saigon. Do you have one for that?
No.
Okay. When the show hit its 4,098th performance, Mamma Mia will celebrate its 10th year on the Great White Way this October 18th. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's obviously a massive hit worldwide. It had a huge hit film, and it's still a massive, massive success story here and in the UK and all its other, shows that tour around the world. It's made it into the big top 10. So now you've got Phantom of the Opera at number one, which has been running 8 years longer than any other show on Broadway right now. So it could end tomorrow and Mamma Mia would have to run another 8 years just to catch up to it. That's how big a hit that is. Then Cats, Les Mis, a revival of Chicago, which is still on the boards, A Chorus Line, Oh Calcutta, The Lion King, also still running, Beauty and the Beast, and Rent. And then You have now Mamma Mia.
The late rapper Tupac Shakur is being honored in a way few music stars ever are. His library is being officially housed at Atlanta University and being made accessible to scholars. The collection includes manuscripts, song lyrics, video, memorabilia, and his letters with family and friends and fans. After 2 years of cataloging the material, it opened on September 13th, the 15th anniversary of his death. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It shows the remarkable continuing influence of Tupac Shakur. We joke that he's the rapper who's had more albums come out after he died than before when he was alive. But it shows rap becoming mainstream, becomes, the source of scholarly work. This is how things like jazz and folk, move into the universities and gain, the recognition and serious attention that they deserve. It's a shame, though, that they did it on the anniversary of his death rather than his birth. I hate it when they do that, especially concerning how he died.
Yeah, I mean, of course, he was assassinated, effectively. He was murdered. And I would agree with you. Why do it on the anniversary of his death rather than on the anniversary of his birth? But needless to say, the hip-hop artist, or any artist for that matter, that is born today, years from now, decades from now, we won't have their letters necessarily, because they will all be emails and they will be kind of part of the ephemera. We won't be actually able to read them unless somebody is smart enough to save them.
Well, I think people do save them. I think, I think people realize now that you should save, that's a valuable resource, especially for an artist. I think that people do save their hard drives. They do save their computers. I would be surprised if they didn't. And certainly the people that they emailed will save them, because a lot of times what you got was not the letter that the person wrote, but it was being saved by the person that they sent it to. You know, that happened in the 1800s as well. So now everybody that Tupac emailed would say, hey, I got a copy of that. Maybe it's lost by his people, but somebody else in the world has it.
That's,
you know,
true.
They should have done the anniversary on June 16th when he was born. But, you know, plus it's, you know, June 16th, 1971. So this would have been his 40th birthday.
Okay.
So
yeah,
it would have been even better. But I guess it wasn't quite ready in time.
Hugh Jackman is coming back to Broadway in the perfect role. After winning the Tony and packing houses with the musical The Boy from Oz 7 years ago, every producer in town has been trying to woo Jackman back to Broadway. He was perfect for a revival of Pal Joey, but his schedule didn't work. But now, finally, he's coming back in the role he was born to play. Himself. Yes, Jackman is doing a one-man show called Hugh Jackman Back on Broadway from October to January. He'll sing, he'll dance, he'll flirt with the crowd and pack him in night after night. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. He's got a movie coming out, that Real Metal or whatever that's called, the sort of Rock'em Sock'em Robot movie.
Real Steel.
Real Steel, thank you. The sort of the mixed martial arts with robots.
How can I remember that? And I can't remember anything else.
But, you know, people have been dying to get him back on Broadway in a show. This is a perfect fit for his schedule. He's there for 3 months. Everybody will love him. Then he gets to move on to something else. You know, you say that a lot with big stars. Bobby Cannavale just got another role on Broadway. He's a terrific actor who goes back and forth between movies and Broadway. He's going to be the male lead in the revival of Funny Girl, which stars Lauren Ambrose in the role made famous by Barbara Streisand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's a fun fit. It's not a big singing role. I don't know if Bobby Cannavale can sing at all, but he doesn't really have to sing very much. He just has to look sort of dangerous and romantic, and I'm sure he can do that. And, you know, other Broadway news, big surprise, the Eagles might be coming to Broadway with a musical called, of course, Hotel California.
Because that's really where you want the musical Hotel California to play, on Broadway in New York City.
That's right. Well, it'll probably start in La Jolla. Maybe that makes sense. Then they'll come to Broadway. But yeah, you know, they've got a jukebox musical waiting to be happening, you know? Well, you want to make money, put those Eagles songs up on stage.
Well, Hugh Jackman did a little, I guess he was trying this out on the road. He already performed this, show, I suppose, in San Francisco.
Oh, did he? I didn't know. Yeah. And of course, he looks like he's going to be starring in the film version of Les Miserables. So, you know, he loves musical theater, so he wants to get back on the stage, and since he doesn't want to commit or hasn't found the right project for, you know, that he wants to spend a year on, this looks like a good fit.
Every writer wants the support of Barnes & Noble when they're launching a new book. How much cooler is it to get the personal support from Barnes & Noble head Leonard Riggio? He had a lunch meeting with the publishers behind a new book by peace activist Lema Gbowee. Did I pronounce that right?
I'm not sure.
Gbowee? She wanted to tour universities and churches to get the word out about her activities promoting peace in Africa, but they didn't have the funds to make it happen. Riggio was so impressed, he wrote her a check himself. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal because it shows how passionate Barnes & Noble and Riggio are about books. I mean, you've got Amazon publishing their own books. You've got Barnes & Noble with their own publishing line. Major publishers are very worried. It's nice to know that, you know, they really do care about books and authors. He's been very concerned about civil rights and activism all his life, and he's putting his money where his mouth is. So, you know, it's a nice thing to see. It doesn't solve the problem of how expensive touring is and that fewer and fewer authors get to do it, but at least in this one case, there's a happy ending.
Well, you know, this peace activist, Lema Gbowee, she was from Liberia, and she wrote about she was a peace activist during the Civil War there. So,
and is one of the key figures that helped end the war.
That's right, yeah.
According to many people.
But I think this is a good idea for bookstores to actually fund these types of tours, because why else would you go into the bookstore?
Right, but they're losing money, so they can't really afford to start shelling out for authors to tour the country.
Fair enough. You know who else is losing money?
Who?
Record companies are looking to diversify their businesses. With falling music CDs, record labels need to find new revenue streams. According to federal prosecutors, someone at Interscope Records, or somebody around Interscope Records, apparently took this idea to an extreme. For almost 2 years, the offices of Interscope Records have been used as a drop-off and pickup point for kilos of cocaine and more than $1 million in cash. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's like the 70s all over again, back when you couldn't even sell a single without giving a guy a line of coke. It's a big whoop. It doesn't, it's not, unless it turned out that officials at Interscope Records were all implicated up and down the line. It's presumably some rogue person, but it's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, they're saying it may not even be anybody who works at Interscope. They may have just been using that particular point as a drop-off point.
That, however, I question a little bit. Really? Some stranger just happened to be showing up at Interscope Records all the time? I mean, I suppose that it happens, but the cross currents between the record industry and drugs are so strong, I find it more likely that somebody was involved some way.
Why should a divorce get in the way of business? Estranged spouses Courtney Cox and David Arquette still have their joint production company and are still on good enough terms to work together. Their latest project is a friend-style ensemble comedy about a group of friends over a decade. Called 10 Years, it might include a role for Arquette, and their amicable split and joint child-rearing might inspire some storylines. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, they got a project in development, but it's interesting to see, even though that they really are amicably split, I guess is the best way to put it. I don't think they're technically divorced yet. I think they're just estranged, but you know, nice to see that they can get along and work together and remain friends, or at least, you know, friendly enough to work to do business.
Is that the difference between estranged and divorced? Divorced is legally divorced and estranged
right,
is on
estranged,
the way?
Right, you're not divorced. You're separated somehow in some way emotionally or physically by distance, and you're not, you know, together, but you haven't gone through with your divorce. That's my understanding of the word.
Okay. Next week on This Week in Grammar.
Well, our guest will be William Sapphire. Anyway.
Exactly. Roman Polanski may be in a legal limbo, but he's ready to edge back into the spotlight overseas. The director of the upcoming film Carnage, the opening night movie at the New York Film Festival, Michael, so get prepared to see that. He will head back to Zurich to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award. The last time he tried to do that, Polanski was arrested and almost extradited to the U.S. Of course, we all know why. I'm not going to go into it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. You know, the Swedish authorities said, hey, you've got no evidence of why we should extradite him back. You're not willing to share it with us. So he's a free man. If he's a free man, why shouldn't he be able to travel back there? So, you know, this is what's going to happen. He has to be careful about what country he goes to, I guess. But, you know, it's a big whoop. It's good for him.
Well, now the Swedish authority said that, but what about the Swiss authority since he's going to Zurich?
Oh, Swiss. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm terrible with geography.
In the UK, yet another country, Michael, that's very close to Switzerland, closer than, say, New York or Los Angeles. Well, never mind. Google is facing pressure from the government in the United Kingdom to act more swiftly against sites accused of illegal downloading. Google recently announced measures to make such sites be bumped way down in search engine results. UK officials want to see them do even more and pledge to speed up the process to identify such rogue and illegal sites, a step that can take many months and which should take weeks or days. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's a tricky position Google is in. You know, companies will say, obviously, hey, you know, they're illegal sites. They shouldn't flash them up on their search engine results, but they're there to provide information. And also they have to be careful about cooperating with governments in the sense of like, hey, the government says you should do this. And like, okay, we'll do that. Well, they get in trouble when they do that in China, and they get applauded when they do that in the UK, at least by the companies. Then they get in trouble with individuals who are unhappy about them kowtowing to the, you know. So it's a very, very difficult position they're in. I empathize with that. There's no reason why, if you can't make a legal finding that there is an illegal site, that they shouldn't have the ability to put it down in search engine results or eliminate it altogether. But the important thing is that there be a legal process in step so that the government is saying, yes, we have officially and legally done a process in which this site has been identified as illegal in, you know, trafficking and
so
illegal
downloads. I mean, you're basically talking about due process there. And
yeah,
I agree
exactly.
With you.
Exactly. You can't just be, hey, get rid of that site. And they go, okay, that's the problem. And I think Google wants to make sure they don't do that for a lot of smart, good, important reasons, not least of which is freedom.
Right.
But it is a tricky position they're in.
Right. Now, speaking of tricky positions, this brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, and everybody's buzzing about this week. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they will affect you, and this story will affect you if you are a Netflix subscriber.
Or as we call it, Quickster.
Quickster, yes. We'll get to that in a second, but earlier in the week, Netflix stock tumbled 19% because subscribers it never had might not sign up. What?
Yes, exactly. This is what drove me nuts about this piece. If you looked at the headlines this week, what you saw was subscribers flee Netflix, Netflix losing subscribers, Netflix loses a million subscribers because of its new pricing policy. Completely untrue. What happened was Netflix had originally said, we anticipate at the end of a certain quarter, we're going to have 25 million subscribers.
That's right.
Then they came out with a revised estimate, which hasn't happened yet, but they say now we anticipate we will have 24 million subscribers at the end of the third quarter. That is not losing subscribers. That's gaining them at a less steady pace. That's a slowing of their growth. That's however you want to characterize it. But 1 million people did not say, I'm leaving Netflix. And every single story I saw got it wrong. Every single one, all over the internet.
How many people did leave Netflix? Do we have that count?
Well, we don't because they don't provide that figure. But we know that they are continuing to grow in subscriber numbers because 24 million will be the largest number they've ever had if they reach that at the end of the third quarter. And we'll know that when the quarter happens. They haven't gone down in subscribers.
Yeah, but
they
continue to grow. In all fairness, the reason Netflix says things like these, they kind of give warnings to shareholders. Hey, we're not going to be as profitable or as...
Well, no. But that's the other thing. They said, okay, we're going to have 1 million less. We anticipate 1 million less subscribers. But by the way, if you keep our top, our top offering, our income will increase 60%. So it's very possible that their revenue would grow dramatically. If you could say, hey, we're going to lose 0.5% of our subscribers, but we're going to, not 0.5, but 5% of our subscribers, but we're going to gain our revenue by 30% or 20% or whatever it might be. That sounds like a win-win. If you can lose 5% of your customers but increase your revenue by 20%, what do you think is good for your business? You'd say, hey, that sounds like a smart business move, right? Instead, they got it wrong. They said a million people left, which wasn't true. They didn't address the fact of whether Netflix has increased its revenue or not, which is a distinct possibility. They might at least be revenue neutral, in which case they made this dramatic switch, cut your service in half, and maintain the same revenue and position themselves for huge growth in the future.
Okay, so here I actually found some figures here. They lost 600,000 subscribers, presumably due to this price increase.
And how many did they gain?
Again, they literally lost subscribers.
What these articles were about. These articles were about their revised estimate for how many total subscribers they would have by the end of the third quarter. So let's not confuse people. Every article that talked about that revised estimate was wrong. They all said they lost a million subscribers. Not true. They lowered their estimate of how many subscribers they would have overall by the end of the quarter.
No, they lost 600,000 subscribers.
That's not what those articles were about.
This is from Netflix. Netflix disclosed that rather than adding 400,000 subscribers in the current quarter, which ends September 30th, it is actually poised to lose 600,000 subscribers. So they're not only not meeting their goal, that's one thing. They're actually losing subscribers. Now that's a little bit more...
They're losing subscribers are walking away. The question is how many new people signed up because the cost of it was half the price that it used to be.
Well, is it half the price?
We don't have that fee. Of course it is. You used to have to pay like
$9.95.
Right, and now it's $8. Well, it's less money.
Yeah, I mean...
It's half the price of what the total cost is now. If all you ever used was streaming, you did a bargain. You cut your price by 20% from $10 to $8.
Well, Netflix projected that it would have 3 million DVD-only subscribers at the end of this quarter, and it expects 2.2 million right now, I suppose. Its estimate for streaming-only customers declined a little from to 9.8 million from 10 million. So obviously, streaming has taken off way faster than they anticipated it.
Exactly. So that's why they say, hey, we should be charging for that. What about does it say about revenue?
The company still expects 12 million people to pay for both services.
Uh-huh. And those 12 million people will have a 60% increase in their cost, which means Netflix has suddenly increased by 60% the amount of money they get from 12 million people. That's as if you signed up an extra... What's 60% of 12 million? About 7 million? That's as if you signed an extra 7 million people at the old cost, or say 6 million. So what's going on there? You've gotten the same revenues if you signed up an extra 6 million people.
Well, because the extra 6 million people mean that if a million people leave you, you're still not kind of on the ropes. Whereas if you're not growing your subscriber base, in fact, if you are decreasing, even if the price is going up and revenues are going up, your churn is higher, which is one of the things that is looked at.
This is a one-time churn. This is not about a churn about every month. This is about a one-time effect from a massive price increase and a massive change in their service. It's not like the churn where every month they lose 600,000 subscribers because they're not changing their pricing policy every year.
Right. I mean, basically, you know, they're expanding internationally into Brazil and into Latin America. They plan on being in Spain next year and possibly even Korea. And, you know, that's all going to be streaming. And streaming is taking off way faster than they anticipated. And maybe the way they handled this particular, price increase is...
Well, we haven't even talked about what they did today.
Right. And, well, I guess they did it late last night. But, I mean, even they are admitting, hey, we may not have done this correctly.
Yeah, but this is bull. They didn't say they did anything wrong. They just said, oh, let us explain further what we did. We're now gonna rename our DVD business as Quickster. And the streaming business will remain Netflix, because Netflix and streaming is where all the money is in the future. And that's what they're going to be doing worldwide. They're going to be just doing streaming for most of the world. They really, when they did this pricing split, they should have said, hey, but we're adding video games. That'll help you. That'll make you happy. They just sent out a letter saying, let us explain further what we did and why we did it. And we're going to rename them so that you'll be less angry. But they didn't say we made a mistake. We shouldn't have done this or that.
Three words. I messed up, from Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix.
But he messed up not by doing the step that they did, by not explaining better why they've done what they did. They have not said we shouldn't have done it, because if they did, they'd say then we're undoing it. And they're not undoing it. They didn't mess up. They messed up in not explaining better why they're taking the steps they did and why they should have. You know, it's clear that we lacked respect and humility in the way we announced the separation of DVD and streaming and the price changes. That was not our intent. And they offer their sincere apology. Let me explain what we are doing. Only thing he's apologizing for is not doing a better job of explaining what they did and why they did it. That's
it. And I thought it got very personal and very, you know, you could learn a thing or two about business. He writes, for the past 5 years, my greatest fear at Netflix has been that we wouldn't make the leap from success in DVDs to success in streaming. Most companies that are great at something, like AOL Dial-Up or Borders Bookstores, do not become great at new things people want, streaming for us. So we moved quickly into streaming, but I should have personally given you all a full explanation of why we were splitting it. And so he then explains.
Right. So I'm right. He's not saying they screwed up by splitting it. He's saying he screwed up by not explaining it better, right?
No, I mean, effectively what he's saying is the cost structures of DVD are totally different than the cost structures
of... For God's sakes, can't you admit I was right? I'm right. He did not apologize and say he screwed up by splitting the services. And
well,
no CEO
is going to out there and say, no CEO. I mean, even when
people do it all the time, they say we made a mistake. We're going back to the old way. Forget new Coke. We're going back to regular Coke. Happens constantly when they screw up. Absolutely. This guy is not saying he screwed up by splitting the businesses, or if he thought he had, then he would put them back together again.
Well, I think we're still in the midst of this.
He's not putting them back together. He's renamed the DVD business Quickster. He's completely rebranded it. He's given it a bizarre new name. It's going to be a totally different business. It has new features. They're going to be separate websites. He's making the split between the two irrevocable and even clearer by renaming the DVD business Quickster.
Yes, but when this happened, way back when, in July of this year, we all said, gee, basically what they're saying is, we're going to charge you $9 for an obsolete technology because, frankly, we don't want to support it anymore. But and that's the reality. That winds up being the reality. They are now splitting the company to do just that. They don't expect to have a lot of subscribers with Quickster. You just heard 2.2
That's
million.
Right. He was right. He says he's right to split up the business. It's the future is in streaming. That's why we're keeping the Netflix name on streaming. But I should have explained it better. That's the only thing he apologized for. But I think it was an interesting letter. I think he's right about it's very hard to adapt to a changing world. We saw that. We saw Blockbuster and Borders repeatedly make mistakes that we could spot at the time, and we've praised Netflix for adapting to streaming. You know, it's very hard to get the libraries to pay the massively increasing amount of money just to get those libraries so they can stream them. You know, it's a constant struggle. They're adapting well. They're expanding overseas. They're making the right steps. I don't know if they'll succeed, but they're, you know, making smart moves as far as I can tell up and down the line.
Well, they're making moves, that's for sure.
Well, you don't think they're right to go overseas and to focus on streaming?
I think that they need to focus on streaming. I don't know that getting rid of your DVD business or splitting it off will make it any more understandable. And now it's just going to be a big pain in the neck. You're going to get two bills for basically the same service, except instead of streaming and DVDs.
Well, but I think they got 12 million people who do both. Yes.
Right. So you're going to get two charges on your credit card.
Well, so, I've... Yeah.
Richard Greenfield from BTIG Research, on his blog, he said that Netflix has had incredible goodwill and resulting word of mouth among consumers, driving down SAC, which is subscriber, the cost of actually getting a subscriber, and creating subscriber growth momentum. We suspect the combination of a large effective price increase and then news that they would be losing some of their highest profile movie content related to Stars has impacted their momentum. Well, that's a duh. but I think really the bottom line is people always had great things to say about Netflix. They always had wonderful and so because of that, they had to market less and it cost them less to actually get a subscriber. That may not be the case moving forward.
I think you're right. They're a mature business, you know.
Yeah, a little bit of a speed bump in that regard.
Yeah, but it's the right move, I think.
Well, time will tell. In fact,
well, if you can get 12 million people to accept a 60% revenue increase, a cost increase in their monthly subscription.
Well, again, it goes back to churn and all of that. But hey, you know what? Speaking of time, we are out of time. We've run over. We did get a lot of emails this past week. We will have to save them for next week, including on the difference between trade libel and defamation and the fact that we kept calling Omar Tyrell. So apologies there.
Oh, did I misspell his name? I do apologize.
We will read your letters and play your voicemails next week. In the meantime, you can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox in iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or in your RSS reader. Please go there, rate us, rank us on iTunes. We'd appreciate it. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you can find links to subscribe, either to the podcast itself, or you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Showbiz Sandbox. You can follow us or like us on Facebook. Again, we're Showbiz Sandbox on Facebook. You can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. And I suggest you go there because they have a new single out, a Bauhaus cover. Now, I'd like to thank Ann Thompson from Thompson on Hollywood, which can be found at IndieWire.com, for joining us to talk about Toronto. Michael, you can be found, or your blog can be found, or your writing can be found, all of your coverage, at MichaelGiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found at CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.